and welcome to Remainiacs. We're recording the day after Boris Johnson spectacularly lost his first Commons vote as PM by 328 to 301. 21 Tory rebels helped Parliament take control of the Brexit process, and all lost the whip for their troubles. Philip Lee performed an all-time mic drop by crossing the floor to join the Lib Dems while Johnson was mid-speech. The government's majority has evaporated, Johnson wants an election, Corbyn say they won't give him one, it's all kicking off and we're here to administer expert VAR. That's football, Ian. We have two of our regulars. I'm not sure if that's how it works, but I believe it is. We have two of our regulars with us. Ian Dunt is editor of politics.co.uk. You covered last night's drama in Parliament. How did it compare to other dramatic mega-thread nights over the past couple of years?
Yeah, I mean, I think pretty good. They're starting to meld into one a little bit. Like, have you come across, like, news stories of shit that you actually lived through that happened, like, 2 months ago, and you're like, fucking hell, I forgot all about that.
Monday, mate. Try Monday.
It seems very important
at the
time.
Have you tried just putting all your threads into one enormous book-length thread and then just putting it out on hardcovers?
No, that's profoundly lazy. But now that you say it, actually, that sounds quite attractive.
No. So none of that.
I mean, like, I thought it was in terms of parliamentary drama, you can't ask for much better than that, really. And I quite enjoyed the foreign, like, lots of foreign correspondents in the US and Canada were tuning in. And one of the main pleasures I get is watching them watch John Bercow. Because just, like, there was one Canadian journalist who took a clip of, like, Bercow talking to Gove about their school and shouting him over and over, like, be a good boy. And her tweet was, can anyone prove that Britain is real?
That was maximum Bercow, that.
It was. That was peak Bercow right there.
And what was the mood in the chamber when Philip Lee crossed the floor?
So I'm sitting up in my offices just above the chamber, right. So I'm not in it because it's impossible to sort of do this stuff fast enough at that point. But, I mean, to be honest, most of those, that didn't even seem like as big a moment as the stuff that came later, I don't think. In that, you know, there was still confusion there. There was uncertainty about exactly what had just happened. Not everyone was looking. The big sort of impact, I thought, was probably when Bercow asked for people to do a shout out on a closure motion ahead of the vote, and you could see how many Tory MPs were stood up to show their part. And just on the basis of that, that's when everyone was like, oh, fucking hell, that was quite, like, that's more than 12, you know, which is around where people estimated it might be. So that seemed to be the moment where it was really hitting home what was about to happen.
Naomi Smith is the tireless CEO of Best for Britain, a sufficiently formidable force to be barred from the Tory conference, missing out on all the good times. Hi, Naomi, how are you?
Good.
Your blacklisting made the news, or the Daily Mirror at least. Were you surprised or did you see it coming?
I don't think anyone's surprised these days by the current regime and the party behind it that are controlling us at the moment. They're trying to shut down Parliament, shut down democracy, shut down debate. So having anyone that might challenge their views on Brexit was probably not going to be welcome at their party conference. But it's fine because we booked our fringe room outside the secure zone in anticipation of this barring. So we'll still have a presence just outside the perimeter fence.
But you won't be able to go to parties with Dominic Raab.
Sadly not, no.
Many moons ago, i.e. Saturday, tens of thousands of people across the country joined last-minute Stop the Coup protests against proroguing of Parliament, and we'll talk about them later. But for now, Naomi, do you think the word coup is apt or a tad overblown, or a tad overblown but useful given the circumstances?
I think the word coup is absolutely fine to use in this context because it is... you know, we keep saying this in the show that this is an unprecedented thing to happen. Conventions are being broken all the time, and there is obviously no mandate for this whatsoever. There is barely a mandate for Boris Johnson as Prime Minister. He's got no majority now, and the whole point of Vote Leave was to get a deal. That was the campaign that they fought, and it was all about bringing back sovereignty to our parliament, and he's tearing that up and taking sovereignty away from them. This isn't what parliament wants. So that's why at Best for Britain we're going to set up an alternative parliament, but we'll probably talk about that a bit later.
Our special guest today is Jonathan Liss, Deputy Director of the think tank British Influence, prolific Brexit analyst. He previously worked in the European Parliament and for the Unrepresented Nations and Peoples Organisation. He's never off Twitter. Now he's in your earbuds. You can't get away from him. Hello, Jonathan. Welcome to Romania.
Because that sounds like something my mother would have written.
He never tidies his room. Welcome, Jonathan. He treats this place like a hotel.
He's always late. Like, yeah, it's, yeah. Well, thank you very much for having me.
During the Tory leadership election, you had a viral thread about the time you got caught up in one of Johnson's lies. And you said in that he gets sort of nasty when he's cornered. And there's sort of disinformation and stuff. Is what he's been doing the last few days, based on what sort of you know of him, does it read as calculated ruthlessness or desperation?
I think with Johnson, it's always all of the above. So what you have seen is personal vindictiveness, a kind of uniquely personal viciousness that he would take the whip away from half the party's grandees. In fact, all the party's grandees. Think about who are the party grandees. Ken Clark, Nicholas Soames. Who are the other grandees, actually? Yeah, Oliver Letwin, Alistair Burr, people like that. The only people who have any credibility left for the Tory party are no longer Tories. So that is the kind of a hallmark of Johnson. He's prepared to ride roughshod over friendships to revenge people who've crossed him. It's also desperation in that he is just trying to pull countermove after countermove in the hope that something works. And above all, it's just a personal hubris that he believes he's born to be in this position. He deserves it. He belongs there. And he's going to do whatever it takes to stay there. And it doesn't matter what or who he has to destroy in order to achieve his goals.
The Dominic Cummings hype squad insists that everybody's walking into his cunning trap. Can you explain what it didn't look cunning last night. Can you explain what Cummings' plan is meant to be, and whether you buy his maverick genius who's read The Art of War and won't stop banging on about it rep?
I think Cummings has been exposed as a genius unloved in his own abattoir. He is a man who has gone through life being told that he's very clever, and he's now being given the chance to exercise power, and he's discovered that he's actually not as clever as he thinks he is. So I suppose the plan was to obviously suspend Parliament so they couldn't sort of scrutinise the plans. They couldn't stop Brexit. If that wasn't going to work, they would call an election and then go to the country on a platform of no deal. But the point about Cummings is that he's actually not interested in the Conservative Party. He's interested in one goal only, and that is to deliver Brexit on the 31st of October. And so when you are prepared, when you have such a narrow view of something, there are things that you simply won't care about, or things that will be unintended consequences which you haven't been looking at, which will in fact derail that single purpose you have. And that is a fundamental mistake that he's made. So last night, you know, nothing can sort of highlight better the scale of his humiliation than, you know, when you think that you're, you know, going to execute a reign of terror and suspend Parliament and everyone sort of breathlessly and fearfully endorsing your genius, and then you're resorting to, you know, shouting drunkenly and incoherently at the people who just humiliated you. And, you know, 6 weeks into office, he's been completely defeated, because there's no way out for him now, because it seems as though the opposition has successfully trapped him into, first of all, blocking no deal, and then they're not going to give him what he wants, which is an election. So there's nowhere for Johnson or Cummings to go at this moment.
Well, the ghosts of Sun Tzu and Bismarck are looking down on Cummings and tutting. We'll be making sense of this wild, wild week throughout the show with help from Jonathan, but first some reminders from Naomi.
A few very quick reminders for you. Number one, if Boris Johnson thinks he can shut Parliament down, he has another think coming. With the support of over 60 MPs from across the House, Best for Britain is setting up an alternative Parliament so our MPs can carry on sitting, debating and defending democracy, whatever Johnson and Cummings try to do. We're crowdfunding a new venue in central London. We've already raised £50,000. We probably need something closer to £100,000, and therefore we need your help to make it happen. Security, etc., comes at a bit of a cost, and we want to keep everybody safe. Visit bestforbritain.org/People's Parliament Fund to pitch in for the People's Parliament. Number two, our next Romaniacs Live at the Leicester Square Theatre with special guest James O'Brien, sold out in record time. But don't worry, if you couldn't get tickets, we're announcing a second house at 9 p.m. on the same day, Monday the 23rd of September, with another brilliant guest. The legendary Mark Gatiss of League of Gentlemen, Sherlock, and appearing on the Romaniacs podcast fame, will be joining us for a separate show with brand new material and a different panel drawn from our regulars. Alex Andreu is confirmed, and we're announcing everyone else soon. Tickets for Democalypse 2019 Round 2, 9 p.m. on Monday the 23rd of September are on sale now at leicestersquaretheatre.com. And if you come to both shows, show your ticket at the merchandise stall and we'll give you a free Ultra Remainer mug. Number three, alongside Romaniacs, our producers make the On The House podcast with Sam Gima, Dr. Philip Lee, and friendly rivals who discuss the week in politics over a pint. They're back for a new series on Friday, and it's been quite a week for them. Philip obviously crossed the floor to the Lib Dems in the middle of Boris Johnson's speech, and they both rebelled and lost the Tory whip. And their special guest is shy, soft-spoken and reticent Labour MP, Jess Phillips. So it really will be quite the listen. Subscribe to On The House on your favourite podcast app to get it as soon as it comes out. As ever, follow us on Twitter at RomaniacsCast to find out more.
Thanks, Naomi. I was at a barbecue over the weekend with normal people that I'm proud to call my friends. And people kept asking what I thought would happen this week. I said, I didn't know. That's why I do a podcast with people who do know. So I didn't see this turning out exactly as it did. So we'll start with the Bluffers Guide. Ian, can you whiz us through what happened on Tuesday night and what it means, like the sort of bare bones version?
Yeah, yeah. So there's been an option which John Bercow has flagged up for some time of basically just trying to create an inroads for parliamentary involvement into what's going on with Brexit. And it's called Standing Order 24, which is basically to stand up and say, look, I want an emergency debate. If the Speaker thinks it's suitable, I mean, this is all, I mean, you know, unconventional, to put it at its mildest. And the Speaker decides that it's okay, you can have a debate on it. It used to be the case that there would be a vote at the end which was neutral. In other words, you couldn't put amendments on it. It didn't really have any meaning beyond saying that this debate had taken place. In this case, it was actually much more meaningful than that. And this basically allowed an opportunity just for MPs to get in there and go, right, what we want next is to take control of the order paper, of the timetable, the next day, which is today, which is Wednesday, in order to try and pass a bill that would force the Prime Minister to extend Article 50 if he gets to October the 19th without a deal. It would extend it for 3 months to January the 31st. After that, if the EU ask for a different date, the Prime Minister will have to accept it within 48 hours unless Parliament says that it won't accept the date. Right. So really, the bill locks in Parliament. Of course, it was portrayed rather predictably as, well, you're giving all the power to the EU. It doesn't do that at all, really. What it says is Parliament needs to be involved at every stage. So they'll be debating that now. There's a bit of sort of back alley cut and thrust going on in the Lords about whether they can kill it with a load of amendments, and lots of peers turning up today with three pairs of clothes and a blanket and, you know, preparing to just spend the whole
the
night
worst there. Glastonbury ever.
Right. but I mean, I suspect it can get past.
They're going to sprawl like mobs.
why not? I mean, in that
picture,
context.
The picture of sort of contemptuous Toryism, wasn't it?
So that's where we are right now. And, you know, it got through the attempt to stop Tory MPs, as you sort of mentioned earlier, was extremely brutal. That failed. We got 21 Tory MPs rebelling, which was above, you know, the estimates that we were coming up with during the day, which is a very strong rebellion. Boris Johnson has savaged his own majority, and we now have to see where we go from here.
Naomi, no deal seems to have united the opposition like never before. Does it really take the apocalypse to get everybody playing nicely?
It seems that way. Obviously, there was good cross-party working happening earlier on in the summer, particularly ahead of the Brecon by-election that, of course, didn't involve Labour. And no to no deal is a pretty easy thing for Labour to get involved with. It's you know, they've always been against that. This isn't a sort of a marked move in a different Brexit direction for them. The meeting that Corbyn held last week, where the party leaders were invited, was, I think, a pretty decent step forward in that regard. I'm thrilled by it at the moment. I think the next thing that is vital is that we talk the SNP and the Labour leadership out of backing a general election before Boris Johnson has come back from Brussels having sought an extension. Mm-hmm. Or some kind of vote of no confidence before that. It's obviously incredibly tempting for the SNP because they are going to take probably all of the seats off Labour and Conservatives in Scotland, so that they are win-win in an election situation. Labour really aren't. There's sort of no poll at the moment showing that they could possibly form a majority. They're going to be reliant on other people's votes. And most of the Labour MPs know this and probably agree with us in the Caroline Lucas position that she came out with first, that we're not going to give you that election until no deal's properly off the table.
We've got a big election bit coming up, so I want to kind of save that. But I'm just wondering, in terms of like the discipline, I think there are only like two Labour MPs
Yeah,
and voted the other way, which is you know, given the kind of fractiousness in the party and there's been a bigger contingent, there's a bigger contingent of Brexiters than that, there is something quite kind of... I mean, obviously, it's appalling that we are facing no deal, you know, sure. possibility. But it is quite bracing to just see everybody just snap in and go, or everybody bar two, and go, fuck no.
And so there's another group tonight that are putting down an amendment that are the sort of Labour dealers, if you like. And I think that includes people like Stephen Kinnock. And I think for some of them, I mean, it's not going to get through. It's not going to get the backing of the government or of the Labour leadership, and everyone listening to this podcast will know that already by the time this goes out. But I think it's usually useful for them to be bought off with being allowed to put that sort of thing down so that they can say to their constituents, look, we tried to get a deal through, but you know, without having to...
Isn't that mainly what they're doing? That's the whole motivation of that group, you know, your Kinnock and Flint and De Piera.
The
whole thing is signalling
right
to their constituents.
Exactly. And when you go back and look back at their voting records, which is something we've done at Best of Britain over the last 24 hours, we've looked at every single vote that's happened over the space of the last couple of years. And we often sort of think, oh, there are all these really difficult Labour MPs. But when you analyse how they've actually voted when it's come to it, not many of them have done really dreadful votes, but they make a huge amount of noise about it beforehand. So, in a bit like Johnson, there's a lot of bluster there.
It's amazing that they're called the Labour dealers because they are, in fact, dealing the most psychedelic drug ever devised, which is a fancy Brexit which works for everybody.
But as long as you pretend that that's what you're going for, then it's job done for them, isn't it?
I think that they really want to. Look, I was thrilled with them last night. Like, I gave Caroline Flint a shout out, which I've never done before, because she has said on the record that she would vote for no deal. And when it came down to it, she and others like Sarah Champion, Emma Lewell Buck, Labour leavers who've said they would in fact back a no deal, when it came to it, they voted for this rebel motion, which will lead to blocking no deal. So it's just another way that Johnson's completely fucked this by turning even sympathetic Labour MPs against him.
Naomi, just go back to you for a sec. You are a Lib Dem. There was some unease among some party members about accepting Philip Lee, given that he had a sort of track record of voting socially conservatively. And somebody, in fact, resigned.
The chair of the LGBTQI Lib Dems.
But given that that was what basically flipped them from having a majority to being a minority government, I mean, did the Lib Dems have any choice? Were they really going to go, no, mate, because of this, you know, said about gay marriage?
I mean, you could have taken away his majority without joining another party. You can cross the floor and not join another party.
But this was more dramatic than...
I do think that it is fairly humiliating for the Lib Dems, who, you know, that are particularly active in the LGBT community, and, you know, my solidarity stands with them. It's not just some social conservative voting. It's been some pretty horrendous comments about all immigrants should be tested for HIV at the border and sent back if they're positive. And that coming from a doctor has extra, you know, power. So actually, I think you've got to really consider whether or not these people are liberals. And a lot of the time they're not. They are true conservatives. They're genuinely conservative. And it's a great pity that there is now no political home for them. I think the vast majority of them will stand as independent conservatives. Actually, the sad thing is, when you analyse the 21, I think there are probably only about 13 of them that are re-standing. There aren't actually that many of them that are re-standing. So the stakes are A, a bit lower for them anyway, and B, you know, the others are probably not going to join another party and will stand as independent.
Do you think any of them? Do you think any more will join the Lib Dems?
I believe that some of them are considering it, but there are. What is much more likely is that they'll form part of the Remain alliance, and that in those seats which are generally Conservative Lib Dem facing, you know, the Lib Dems are in a strong second. The Lib Dems may do a non-aggression pact, or even not stand a PPC against the independent Conservative.
My dream is that basically we get to a point where every single MP is an independent, and everybody just does what they
libertarian fantasy.
Everyone just does what they feel like on the day, and then just see what happens. Jonathan, last week, Ruth Davidson, generally popular Tory, one of the few, decided to step down. Justine Greening and others won't stand again. Last night, I was at the GQ Awards, and Rory Stewart came straight from the Commons to say that he was accepting Politician of the Year award on the evening that he effectively, although not literally, you know, sort of ceased to be a politician, was his gag. Is the Tory party now the Brexit party, essentially? Is this just the collapse of the idea that that it's a sort of broad church and you can be a kind of strong Remainer and a Tory.
Yeah, I mean, it became the Brexit Party many, many months ago. Theresa May saw to that when she went for the hardest Brexit available to her, pandered to the ERG for 2 years, despite the fact that they were obviously going to be the ones who shafted her in the end, which they were. And they left no space for anyone to protest for a soft Brexit, which was highly suggested by the referendum results, including a Norway plus customs union, which people like me were fighting for 2 years before the polarisation took place and we were shunted to either side. So now people like me are not talking about Norway. I mean, I went to court to argue for Norway and now I can think of, well, of course, there's something worse than Norway, which is a no-deal Brexit, but certainly people like me are arguing all out for Remain now. And that is absolutely because of what the Conservatives did when they took a result which was basically slapped down in the middle pretty much and decided to go for a very, very hard right-wing interpretation which suited Theresa May's incredibly xenophobic mindset.
But this is different, right? Because we, in the past, we've got our hopes up about Tory rebels and pretty much all of them who aren't called Dominic Grieve flinched, and even, you know, Dominic Grieve a couple of times believed sort of May's bullshit when you shouldn't have.
Yeah.
This time they actually knew in advance that they were risking deselection, but they did it anyway. So what changed? Do you think, what made all those people decide, I'm literally going to throw my career on the fire over this?
Because now we're at the business end of Brexit. And the time for games is over. So this is the last chance. Do people want to go down in history as the politicians who facilitated a collapsed economy, food and medicine shortages by the government's own estimation, sort of a complete international pariah status? Or do they actually stand up for the people they're elected to represent? It's now or never. And so people like Caroline Noakes, who none of us would have dreamed could possibly rebel, a former immigration minister during the Windrush scandal, who none of us had very much time for, stood up and said, I was elected to serve my constituents. They're worried about their livelihoods. I don't see how I could put my job ahead of theirs. Now, that should be completely normal. And the fact that that was totally extraordinary tells us everything we need to know about the current state of the Conservative Party and the careerist poison which is coursing through that party's veins.
I think there's something starting to happen now. It's early days and it could change. But when a government doesn't have a majority anyway, it's hard for it to get sort of the confidence of its own MPs. When the strategies that you've been pursuing keep on demonstrably failing, and when the narratives that you're putting out there just don't make enough sense on their own terms, even for the guys on the Today programme to take them seriously, even they're just left going like, well, that's just obviously nonsense. You can't say that there's talks that are being interrupted when you're not holding any talks.
And yet, the Today programme at certain points just seem to have sort of given up.
Yeah.
You know.
On being even remotely charitable. I mean, today Nick Robinson was basically saying, you know, Boris Johnson's a liar. Mm. You just get to a point where it's
He praised Corbyn yesterday as well.
I mean, how do you get... I mean, just how can you take the narrative seriously? And in fact, I've had sort of radio interviews this week where they said, well, what is Boris Johnson's narrative? What's he saying? And even saying it out loud, it actually sounds sort of contradictory. It sounds internally inconsistent because it just doesn't make any sense. And then you see the strategy, a very, very hard-line strategy, which is, you know, which to Tory MPs, it will be more obvious to us just how hypocritical it is when he was obviously voting against Theresa May's stuff. And now when people do the same to him, they're out the party.
Yeah.
Guys who younger MPs, like myself, would have grown up seeing figures like Ken Clark on the front bench their entire life, you know?
Yeah.
And to suddenly see that, and then where these questions come from of, actually, does Dominic Cummings have Tory party membership? Or then worse, has he actually even voted Tory? I mean, he's got stuff out there that suggested that the first time he ever voted was for the referendum, which means he's not even a Tory voter. So suddenly, I mean, this morning, even from figures who are really quite Brexity indeed, there was some nervousness about what was going on with the government. There was some anger about the way that they treated some of the other MPs there. So actually, I think like this moment can be quite powerfully effective in sort of going, well, actually, the regime looks like it is nothing like as effective as it sold itself as being.
Yeah, we spent the whole summer thinking, is there a plan B? You know, is no deal really the plan A? And I have people in Number 10 leaking to us saying, trust me, no deal is the plan. There is nothing else being worked on. Other people saying, no, this is all a ruse. You're underestimating Cummings. Don't be foolish. There will be some kind of a deal. He'll do something. There will be a plan B. And I think yesterday, once and for all, we saw they have no plan B. they were all out for this, and they did not see prorogation not working.
Well, according to one of those leaks that Cummings absolutely refuses to tolerate, Cummings referred to sort of negotiations as a sham.
Yeah. He was speaking the reality.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the most extraordinary thing about Brexit for the last 3 years is that we have suspended our disbelief completely. And anyone who has any understanding of the EU and who spoke to any middle-ranking official in the EU would have said, these are our red lines, we're not going to budge on them because our political integrity depends on it. And yet, we still talked about, oh, no, they're going to budge on the transition, they're going to budge on the divorce bill, they're going to budge on Ireland, they're going to throw Ireland under the bus because how could Ireland's interest possibly sort of trump ours? And all of this stuff, which is simply the self-fulfilling fantasy of our own delusion.
There's an amazing detail from Sky News where they reported that a draft version of the UK's revised protocol for the backstop was just the old protocol, with the sections referring to the backstop cunningly crossed out.
And Johnson's going to talk to Varadkar next week, and it's going to be the summit. I mean, probably quite an entertaining summit to watch, but Varadkar is not going to kind of placate or appease him in any way, and it's just going to be yet another humiliation for Johnson. But coming back to the point we were just talking about a minute ago, I mean, I just have to ask, what were the Tories expecting? What were the Tory leadership expecting in purging all their grandees? I forgot even to mention Philip Hammond and David Gawke before. I mean, other sort of major grandees. What we have seen now is a level of personal poison in the Tory party, which we haven't seen since the 90s. It's totally extraordinary that in just 6 weeks, they've achieved what not even Theresa May could achieve, which is a deep-rooted hostility and antagonism between the Tory leadership and the backbenches, which is now basically all-out Tory civil war. We saw it in the Commons last night and today, with MPs standing up to denounce each other on the same side. A party that's divided cannot normally win an election.
Well, Hammond referred to Cummings on the Today programme as an entryist and made that point that you were saying, Ian, about is even a Tory. In just, you know, in a very short space of time, he has had more negative press. He's become the story way more than, you know, Seamus Milne. There's a certain media fascination with Seamus Milne as the sort of power behind the throne there and a shifty, unelected figure. Cummings has just, like, blown that away. It makes that almost look irrelevant. And now he's being like a sort of Geordie Robespierre going around lopping off heads. Has he just sort of overplayed his hand and kind of gotten high on his own supply and just convinced himself that he can't be stopped? Because it just seems like he's just so unpopular within the party now.
There's a really good piece by Tom Chivers on the Unheard website about this. Basically, Tom Chivers saying, look, I seem to read the same people that he reads, the kind of people that he refers to as, you know, sort of the rationalists online, you know, the right sort of... There's an awful lot of game theory going on there, and the Slate Star Codex. Some of these, they're actually very, a lot of these sites are really quite interesting. Although they all deal, just like he does, with tremendously long blogs where you start reading the first two parts, you're like, oh, it's such a strange thing. And then you're like, oh, this is 9,000 words long. I don't know if I'm quite that committed.
He is the long blog post come to life.
And, you know, Tom Chivers' argument was like, well, he's read the same guys. I can tell he's read the same guys, but he clearly hasn't come to the right conclusion from what they're doing. And so mostly, you think of it, he just seems to be playing a massive game of chicken. You often see something quite similar, actually, when business people go into politics, and they also have a quite simplistic idea. You bring them in and they're like, well, I'll just do this, and then it happens, and then off we go. And that works in business, and it fucking does not work in politics. Just saying you want someone to do something is the beginning of a process, not the end.
Generally, people going from politics into business have a more successful career than those coming from business into politics.
Yeah, well, exactly. Yeah. And so it looks like he is one of those sort of rationalist guys, and it looks like he hasn't taken the right lessons and is, as ever, massively overconfident. At some point, it might be we're going to have a conversation about angry, overconfident men and the impact that they are having on
Ian, why don't you go into politics?
So yeah, look, we do need to have that conversation at some point. I think he's a kind of an exemplar of that problem.
Can we have before we move on to all kinds of stuff coming up? Could we just have a quick summary of PMQs and how Johnson performed and how the sort of Johnson Corbyn chemistry is working?
It's bad, man. I mean, I'm surprised by how bad Boris Johnson is. Genuinely surprised.
I mean, he looked really, even before PMQs, but earlier this week, his speech outside Number 10, I thought he looked bad and sounded bad and
he's
was very, very
mojo.
Wobbly. And thank you very much to everyone that was outside Number 10 chanting, "Stop Boris," because that was absolutely right. And I think that really threw him. I think that was part of it. He wasn't expecting to hear the roar against him.
I think the honeymoon ended when he went to Wales and Scotland and was booed. You could see in his body language that he doesn't like that. He wants to be loved.
How long has it taken for all that dude language to dissipate? Yeah. And he's now showing that like
the mask
figure.
Has slipped. Yeah. He's the authoritarian, desperate, the boy emperor who's desperate to hold on to power. And PMQs was extraordinary in so many ways, actually. Just to see Johnson make Corbyn look like the parliamentarian, look like the statesman. Yeah. So Corbyn asking very, very calm, reasoned questions, Johnson responding like he's at the Oxford Union, jabbering and wailing about the surrender bill. It's such a terrible, terrible look. It doesn't do anything for him. And then to have a Labour MP confront him on racism, on the racist comments he made about Muslim women, and for Johnson literally to respond that he was making a liberal defence, which Jo Swinson then picked him up on, and then for Margot James, the MP, to spit out the name of Dominic Cummings and have sort of really launched a very ferocious attack at Minister until a few weeks ago. Johnson was just collapsing every time. He had no answers to anybody. And I think that he's a busted flush, really.
Mm. Amazing.
It's quite interesting, the tone of the Commons recently and the kind of questions that are asked. Like all the way through yesterday, there was, for a start, there was this really sullen silence on the Tory side. Now, that is not, you've got a new government. You know, that's not usually the way things are. Usually there's all of the confidence. Even when you've just replaced the old Prime Minister, like when Theresa May came in, do you remember the degree of boisterousness and confidence and noise that you would get? Then also, look, the kind of questions that Johnson is being asked all the time, the kind of questions that Jacob Rees-Mogg was asked, were all very precise.
Yeah.
It was, on exactly which date did you send this note that it went off? And what's interesting about that is MPs starting to acclimatise the fact you're dealing with an administration based on bluster.
Yeah.
And the best way to deal with bluster is forensic questioning.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So actually you're looking at Parliament and thinking, like, not just in the bigger constitutional way of Parliament taking on government, but you're also thinking, like, on quite precise ways with individuals, you guys seem to be understanding what it is that you need to do.
Well, we're going to be talking about the election and also the protests a little later. But first, we're going to have a lovely chat about clothes. Support for this week's podcast from some Stitch Fix, the personalised styling service that handpicks new clothes just for you and sends them to your door with free shipping and free returns. Romaniacs listeners are, of course, a stylish bunch, but shopping for clothes is time-consuming and can be tedious, especially now that we're spending our Saturdays protesting to protect democracy, instead of looking for a nice shirt. Stitch Fix takes the time and inconvenience out of dressing well, and it works for men, women and kids, but not animals. You just fill out an online style quiz to tell them a little about what you like to wear, your budget, your body shape and so on, then your personal stylist will send you 5 items of clothing chosen just for you from hundreds of the best European brands. You can try everything on at home, so there's no pressure from shop assistants. Just keep what you like and return everything else. Delivery and returns are both free. You just pay a £10 styling charge, and even that is deducted from anything you buy. Find out more, sign up today, and get £15 off your first styling experience at stitchfix.co.uk/remain. I don't like show shopping. I got sent a bunch of clothes in a box, and that was nice.
Mm.
And there's a Czech shirt that I intend to wear, because it kind of looks like the shirts that I already wear.
Yeah, you're quite big on the Czech shirts.
I'm quite big on me and Ed Sheeran. So yes. But then they also tried other things. They push you out of your comfort zone. I don't like being pushed out of my comfort zone because it's comfortable. That's the point of the comfort zone. So I will be returning those items.
but listeners, you can select like never. They ask you that question in up front, like, you know, to what extent are you happy to be outside your comfort zone on casual clothes, you know, smart clothes, going out, you know, occasion wear for weddings, etc. And if you just click never, never, never.
No, but my problem is I don't have a comfort zone when it comes to clothes. That's I think that's why I probably need a site like that.
I've used one of these before. I quite like, because I'm not great with shopping. I get quite sweaty. Like really fast, and I just like have this feeling.
That's really bad when trying on clothes.
Especially for the guy after you.
I really hate it.
I feel it, and I'm walking with all these clothes into the changing room. I'm looking at like the store assistant, who's invariably really glamorous. And I'm just thinking, I know you think I'm going to sweat all over your clothes.
I am
going to do that. Like, yeah. So I find that experience quite dreadful. And there's like this feeling in my stomach, just like, just please let this be over.
And I have bought items of clothing just to be polite because I've taken so many into the changing room. It's like, I've got to buy something.
Haven't we all done that?
Your assistant was nice. And I don't know. I don't want to be rude and go,
why do you think I'm wearing this shirt? I was in the shop for an hour.
I also think it's quite good. So I mean, I'm a huge fan of online shopping. I've done the vast majority of all my shopping online for, you know, decades now. I was a really early adopter of it. But what's different about this, this isn't just online shopping. It is about, you know, suggesting things for you. But you do get it. What I like is that it serves you with some... samples, like, is this the sort of outfit you would like? And you can click yes or no. So I think they really do try to tailor it to you to minimise the number of returns, because obviously, you know, carbon footprints and all that, we don't want to be returning clothes all the time and doubling up on the amount of delivery. So, yeah, I really like that about them.
So that's Stitch Fix, your own personal stylist. Take the time out of clothes shopping. Make sure you look good when you're out there saving democracy. Get started today by going to stitchfix.co.uk/remain. Let's move on to Gone in 60 Seconds, our regular feature where one of our panel has just one hot minute to completely debunk a treasured article of faith on the other side. This week's One Minute Man is Ian. He's been away for weeks.
Now, is it?
Yes. He's on the ball as ever.
What is it? What am I doing?
What?
Ian, 60 seconds.
You know.
Yeah, no, I understand. But what's the but what's the subject?
Wait, I'll get on to it, man.
I'll get on to it.
Literally. Jump ahead.
You'll
okay,
be fine.
Right. No, sorry. Excellent.
Ian, your lever argument is the referendum was more democratic than a general election. It's obviously nonsense. Tell me why in 60 seconds.
Oh, I see. Right. Yes. Well, I mean, the issue there really is specificity, isn't it? You could easily have a referendum that was just as valid. I mean, I think the classic one is that 1999 Australian one on the monarchy, which was, do you want the monarchy or do you want this other specific system which we are highlighting to you here? And you can make a call on that. If your referendum is, would you like the status quo or something else, then you really haven't specified anything in order to come up with a policy solution to it. Now, that is not really the case in general elections. In general elections, which have many weaknesses, not least, you know, first past the post, and not least the fact that you don't really know if someone's voting for a candidate or for a party or for a particular manifesto commitment and not another. But nevertheless, there is at least a policy programme that is being put by a government. And by voting for that candidate, you know that you are making that policy programme more or less likely. So on that basis, unless you have a higher degree of specificity, I think it's quite dangerous and in fact has got us into an awful lot of trouble to treat the referendum as if it's a superior form of democracy.
Bosh. Thanks, Ian. Moving on.
Get you in just a minute.
Fucking hell. We do as little of that as possible.
Has anyone ever talked about Brexit in just a minute?
God knows.
I'm sure. Maybe it's not allowed.
I don't think they go near that shit, because that's the last... Like, if you're in just a minute, it's like, it's a nice Sunday. Yeah, you're like, it's like, you, the last thing you want is like, oh, have a bit of horrible...
I mean, Brexit
hellfire.
Is repetition and deviation.
Oh, very good. And a lot of... And 3 years of hesitation.
Naomi Smith is available for all Radio 4 panel shows.
Now she's a Today programme regular.
Moving on, do we or do we not want a general election? It's very confusing. Last week, the People's Assembly announced that their protest on Tuesday was going to be a slogan, demand a general election now. Tony Blair then said it would be an elephant trap to back an election, while no deal was still an option. Corbyn said he wanted one anyway. Then Johnson said he wanted one. And then Corbyn said, no, actually, fuck off. Not until no deal is ruled out. Ian, is the Fixed Term Parliaments Act, which has not been an unalloyed good, sort of finally come good? Because Johnson can't call a snap election unless Labour gives it to him, right?
Well, yeah, OK, so yes, a good thing has happened to do with the Fixed Terms Parliament Act, and the even stop clock tells the right time twice a day. However, even now, Boris Johnson, if he wants to, could just pass a bill going, notwithstanding Fixed Terms Parliament, you can do that any time, right? Any piece of legislation overrules
previous legislation. That's to go through the Commons and Lords.
Yeah, but it wouldn't need the two-thirds majority. Right. So you just, you know, get a bill out there, you can get rid of the problem that you've got, you just need, you know, a majority plus one.
Where's this majority coming from?
Yeah. That's the thing, should have done that a few months ago. Yeah.
Okay, that's true. But nevertheless, in terms of the actual lock that is placed on him, that almost insurmountable lock, he can still get over it fairly easily. And any normal government would be able to get over it fairly easily.
This ain't no normal government.
So nevertheless, so you think something good has come of it, but it's kind of, even now, you could sidestep it sort of fairly easily, really. I don't think there's too much of a trouble there. And still, when you look at it, it's a pretty grim piece of legislation that showed very little foresight for how things would operate in the future.
Jonathan, is Johnson preparing for an election based on the people versus Parliament? Does this kind of drama, is that going to sort of serve his message? It's obviously not helping him in Parliament, but would it be good sort of thing to say to the country, go, look at these people getting in my way?
Well, absolutely, that's what he wants, and he's going to repeat exactly what Theresa May did. She literally went to the people on the People versus Parliament and said, opposition are trying to thwart Brexit. I think those are her exact words. So give me the negotiating hand to get the Brexit, and look how that turned out. But the problem is, for Johnson, is that if he brings over voters from one flank, he'll simply lose them on the other. So if he goes to the people, assuming he gets this election, which I don't think he will in the next few days, but assuming he goes to the people on a no-deal platform, Nigel Farage will roll over. But what you would see is then a unique anti-Tory coalition, where it's pretty much the only situation where you can get Corbyn and Swinson working on the same page, where in the national interest, facing an unprecedented national crisis, you would have Labour and Lib Dem voters, SNP plaid, whatever, mm-hmm. holding their noses to vote for whichever candidate was most likely and best placed to stop the Tories. So that would actually be a very, very high risk gamble for Johnson. And if Johnson doesn't go to the people on delivering no deal, then Farage will stand against him and he'll tear up the Tory vote.
I mean, I think that's it. I think the people versus Parliament thing only works for him before the 31st of October, and it's then Farage's mantra if it goes on beyond that. He's in this sort of desperately weakened state at the moment, and he will be even more severely weakened if the 31st of October comes and goes. He's effectively being held hostage in number 10 at the moment because we're not giving him the election that he wants. I mean, and it's important to pile this mess onto him as much as possible,
So we're talking about two radically different scenarios before October 31st and after October 31st is a completely different set of sort of calculations.
Or after the October, summit, I would say, know if there's going to be a deal or not, which there probably won't be, etc.
Yeah.
We know it is pretty clear what he wants now. We know that he won the election. So, and of course, opposition parties want elections too because they want to be in government. So the solution has to be, how do we make him getting what he wants take place in the worst possible scenario for him?
Monkey's paw him.
Is that what that is?
The monkey's paw. You know when you wish on the monkey's paw and you get what you wish, but there's a horrible twist.
Oh, yeah.
What's that from?
It's like an old, it's like a short story, like a Somerset Maugham short story. Oh, okay. Or like a myth.
That seems to be
basically his whole prime ministership is a monkey's paw situation, isn't it?
Like a theory of victory on it. And so you sort of think, well, what's the timing? Where can you be forced into? And I think the two things that are crucial are, firstly, he needs to kill the Brexit Party. And if you're putting him in a position where the Brexit Party will compete for those votes, you've minimised his chances of success.
Yeah.
If you fail to do that, then I think John's sort of strategy works. And then you're like, right, we're all in now for an existential fight for the face of the country. But first of all, you try to have that split in place. And secondly, you know, he wants to be doing it when he's buoyed up in the polls, when he's got that bounce from just having come in. He's presented himself as this super macho, all of the sort of, you know, I have all of the momentum, I have all of the strength on it. So put him into a position where that is no longer true. And my instinct for that is, sort of as Naomi's saying, just get him into a position where he either has to go for that extension, break everything that he's said so far, and then as soon as he's done it, we have an election. Or, you know, he has to consider resigning.
He snookered himself. I mean, he either has to lift prorogation to try and do something himself through Parliament, or he has, you know, and if he has to go cap in hand to the EU Parliament, again, that's exactly not what he's wanting to do. Or he's, you know, having to do some kind of very, very dirty thing with the Brexit Party. But he hasn't got the numbers. As long as, and I've said it earlier at the start of the show, we need SNP and the Labour leadership to hold firm on not giving him this election until that extension has been granted.
But Naomi, the genius point is that we can save the face of the opposition parties because Corbyn has now said or implied strongly that he's not going to allow an election, which is in his gift, of course, until it not only the Commons has voted for it, this bill, but until it's on the statute books. Mm.
So that takes us to next Monday.
Yeah.
So that means that even if you were to call an election, vote for an election next Monday, it would take you after the EU summit.
And we're supposed to be prorogued from next Monday.
Right, exactly.
So he's just facing all these humiliations.
Right, but that means that he'll have to go under law, because you are not allowed to hold an election.
Or he will defy the law. And that isn't beyond the realms of possibility at this stage. As I understand it, the courts are ready for that, right up to the Supreme Court, and they're prepared to sit through the night to take this on if
they need
to.
I mean, we're talking about a real actual coup.
Well, I mean, a coup combined with a purge, you know, 20th century is littered with people like this.
Because what's sort of fascinating is for 4 years really since Corbyn has been Labour leader, we've had talks about the kind of like I said earlier, you know, having an unelected kind of hardline advisor, but also, you know, purges and deselections, and this has been a lot of the kind of anti-Corbyn narrative. It seems to me that he's helped enormously by the Tories just leapfrogging it and all the stuff that was going, Labour might do this, they're talking about these elections. And then suddenly, like, Johnson and Cummings are just like, you're all out. It makes Corbyn look like
the hilarious thing is that the Tories are trying to paint Corbyn as a radical while literally shutting down Parliament and threatening to...
But that's it, they've gone so far in the direction of everything that they've accused Corbyn of doing that Corbyn actually hasn't, in many cases, hasn't actually got round to doing.
And he's looking like the grown-up in the room, which is exactly what they didn't want.
He just needs to hold... He needs to hold firm now, and I think that there's hints that he is getting it, but the temptation will always be, right, let's just go for this. And he wants elections. He likes elections.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so...
He's actually quite good at them as well.
Yeah, and he is good at them. Yeah, people underestimate that. And so he needs to just be held back a bit on that, and it's not clear whether that'll hold. The prorogation actually... then suddenly, as long as you've got that bill on the statute book, the prorogation actually shifts because you've neutralised no deal. So actually time works to your advantage on the Remain side, because suddenly you're just pushing and pushing closer to the point where Boris Johnson would have to be in that position in late October. Mm-hmm. So you've just got to sort of just kind of get there, just get basically to next Tuesday, really, without giving in on this stuff, which is not easy. I mean, it's not an easy position to go in front of cameras and be like, we've been complaining about a coup for the last 2 weeks. I've been saying I want a general election for years, but I don't want this one.
I don't want it on his terms. It's just, it's easy to defend.
It could be done, but of course, it's a difficult...
There's just one thing that I wonder about an election, is that at the moment, the fear of no deal, like, is rallying people, you know, everybody against Johnson.
Interesting. Yeah.
A lot of centrists, you know, centre-right, centre-left, centre-centre, would reluctantly sort of accept Corbyn rather than no deal. I mean, you know, I've noticed that the general criticism, even people that don't like Corbyn, that's not really what they're talking about at the moment. If no deal is blocked... Mm. Does that then mean that all those kind of reservations come back, and once the immediate threat has gone, people are less inclined to kind of suck it up and go for Corbyn? Or is there so much else that is repellent about this awful fucking government that actually people that generally really can't stand Corbyn would just go, do you know what, it's better than this?
I think Corbyn just has to do one thing, which is to convince enough people that he is going to call a second referendum and that he's going to campaign for Remain. So many of the people who've abandoned Labour have done it because they don't trust him to do that, because they want Labour to be a Remain party. I think Labour is almost there. And if they just get nudged over that line in their manifesto, that should be enough. Now, what you have, it should be enough for some people, not everyone, of course.
Because I've got the MRP at my fingertips. The data on all of this, we are not going to see a repeat of 2017.
No.
There is no scenario under which Labour are going to have the number of Remain votes behind them that were lent to them in 2017 as they do now.
Yeah.
We are not in a situation where any of the parties at the moment can form any kind of majority government. The only way the Conservatives can are if Farage does what he keeps saying that he'll do, which of course we know he won't do if the 31st of October comes and goes before that. And so Lotto know this. They know that they are going to have to work with the SNP and potentially the Lib Dems as well. I think what is focused focusing their minds at the moment is how quickly the mood of the country could turn against them on this whole, we've always said we wanted a general election and now we're saying we don't. And I think that's what they're a bit worried about, particularly in some of the Labour Leave heartlands around the country. You know, all you've talked about is wanting a general election. You've been offered it. We can tolerate you, you know, delaying it for a little while, but really now. So I think that's what's worrying them, and we've got to get them to hold firm, because otherwise we're still in that danger zone of crashing out accidentally.
But you've also got Brenda from Bristol. You've got the Brenda from Bristol counter argument, which is the people actually don't want to go to the polling booths all the time. And if you can prove that you're being principled in opposing this election, you're going to do it on your terms. And actually, that's neutralised.
That's the message we need to get to them. But a YouGov poll, literally just out as we've been on air, is the general election now wanted by the public in mid October? And we think that that's mostly coming from Conservative voters swinging behind it when they were against it a few weeks back.
But the Conservatives are still surprisingly quite a bit ahead of Labour in the polls.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Do we expect that to change after this shit show?
There's going to be some reduction from where they are now. This is going to be, presumably, we think, the high watermark for where they're going to be. But really, for an election, that the most important thing is where are your votes rather than how much.
Yes.
Yeah.
And, you know, what you need to worry about is obviously Lib Dem Tory marginals. You need to worry about Scotland, which it looks like he'll pretty much lose everything.
South West as well.
That's going to be where this whole thing is decided. I do think, look, there's no two ways around. I was thinking about this morning. I'm thinking, like, this isn't like a hill I'd die on with this stuff, because there are strong arguments for the other way. There are strong arguments for just get the bill down. I mean, of course, if he gets a majority, he can repeal it. But when you start getting too clever with your little chess pieces, the public can just look at it and be like, I don't like the fucking smell of what you're doing over there. If you want the fucking election, then go ahead and have it.
Yeah.
So I say all of this with trepidation, but it does seem to me like right now, like, if it's clear what he wants, it is important to give it to him in the worst possible terms. And the worst possible terms, I think, are very, very clear.
Finally, it might not actually be a coup, but the Stop the Coup protests seem to have re-energised Remain in time for the big march October 19th. You can find updates on local protests on Twitter at Tech4UK. Naomi, you were in Exeter.
Yeah, I was.
How was that? What was the atmosphere, and what kind of people were there?
It was incredible, actually. It was truly cross party, and a lot of them weren't. And so I'm sort of glad to have the chance to talk about this, really. So in Exeter, we had Ben Bradshaw, we had Sarah Wollaston, now Lib Dem, we had a Lib Dem MEP, we had the Labour group leader on the council, we had me, we had a union rep from UCU, we had a local Green activist. So it was properly cross-party, and Devon for Europe got a really great look in. In other parts of the country, the feedback to me at Best of Britain has been, where the hell were these guys for the last 3.5 years? You know, the grassroots groups are pretty angry that this is now becoming a bit of a momentum takeover and a bit of a rehabilitation exercise for Labour. There were some areas, particularly, I think, Labour, Leeds and Liverpool, where the Labour speakers were just sort of back to back for 40, 50 minutes, and people were out there standing in the rain saying, I didn't come out to hear from these guys for so long. The whole point of this is that there is a cross-party effort uniting against this coup, against Boris Johnson, against No Deal. And so the groups that have been, you know, bless them, weekend after weekend, for 3.5 years, you know, doing the hard graft on this, keeping the fire of Remain alive around the country, a bit cross about that. But, you know, it is absolutely right that people keep doing it every Saturday from now on, you know, making sure that you're finding out where your local group is meeting and going along and making as much noise as possible is crucial.
Well, the really insulting one, I think, was the People's Assembly one, where they had Eddie Dempsey and Tariq Ali, who were both like pro-Brexit, which led, I think, Owen Jones and Ash Sarkar to drop out.
Yeah.
And it was just like, if you cannot at this point in time be anti-Johnson and pro-Brexit.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It was just the absolute addled mindset of that organisation. You know, the two are intertwined.
Even now, I find it like, you know, you can feel the sort of movements pulling together, and all of which is a good thing. But even now, when I'm talking to sort of Corbyn guys online, I'm so exasperate. Because, of course, what you get back is like, and now you see his master plan has come into force that you denied. Yeah. And you're like, Jesus, God, man, really? Like, if I have to keep on reading this, it's going to be impossible for me to show any solidarity whatsoever. So I just need to go away. So even now it's difficult, but it is necessary.
Jonathan, how important are these protests? Because they're not, I mean, relative to, say, size of a People's Vote March, which is obviously planned for weeks in advance. You know, these were very ad hoc. They were smaller, but, you know, significant given how quickly they came together. And it seemed to kind of represent a kind of a real sort of disgust and rage. It wasn't so much the kind of like, the signs were not so much the kind of jolly ones that we've seen on kind of a lot of Remain protests. It seems like it's quite a welcome for a new PM. Do you think they're going to turn into something more? I'm not, maybe not kind of, you know, UK Maidan protest, but do you think they will evolve when now there is actually more time to sort of plan, that it will become something more long term, a refusal to accept this government?
I think it really depends on what happens in the next weeks and months. I mean, there was a really interesting moment where Johnson came out and obviously he had stopped the coup, shouted, you know, in the background, and there was a garden party happening. And I sort of tweeted that it was like the French Revolution meets Brideshead Revisited. So that can definitely spiral, if you like, if Johnson continues to flout the rule of law. We'll see what happens, the prorogation, we'll see what happens in the election campaign if the Tories do go on a platform of no deal. I think that will lead to real anger, real fear, and that will increasingly lead to street protests as well. But I think the problem with protest is it's really important to show what you're thinking, but and to show the depth of feeling. But it's unclear how much protest actually affects policy making and decision making in Parliament, because, you know, always go back to 2003 and the Iraq War demonstrations, and we still went to war in Iraq.
Naomi, do you think you've been a lot, you're organised and, of course, been on a lot of these Remain marches, branded in differently, a lot of these Remain marches. And like I said, the mood is often very kind of like jolly and family friendly and rather wry placards. Do you expect the one in October to have a darker, angrier mood? I'm not talking full on black bloc going for the windows of the Ritz. But just like a harder edge to what we've seen.
Certainly more somber. Yes. Also, it's going to totally depend whether or not we're in a general election period at that stage, in which case I'm not entirely sure it could necessarily go ahead because of election spending rules and the sheer expense of putting on those events would take you over your limit. And remember the weekend before this, also on the Rally for Our Rights, for those that had booked their tickets before the date got changed and still wanted to have a protest. But yeah, your substantive point is it's less about, you know, having a witty sort of cartoony kind of placard and is there something a bit more serious? And I think, yes, it absolutely is. And we're seeing that in these mini demonstrations. And just to say that, yes, of course, there weren't the numbers at these ones last weekend that there were at the People's Vote marches, but the People's Vote marches don't cannibalise each other's events. They're always in London, and people come from all over the country to go to them. Mm-hmm. If they were happening in 32 places around the country, you would probably see, you know, similar-ish numbers.
Yeah,
it was immense in Parliament yesterday. I mean, you really like
felt
you could,
it. Yeah,
yeah, you could feel it because of the drums, man. God, I love the sound of those drums. Like, as always, you actually feel like the fucking armies are at the gates.
Yeah.
Right?
Well, every interview that you hear on the radio, there's kind of voices in the background and drums, and it's like...
Yeah. There's a unique energy. There's a unique energy in Westminster, like in College Green.
College Green is wild.
College Green is turning into one of the most insane spots in Britain. Yeah,
I was doing a great place to meet people.
Networking. I might do a bit of speed dating next time. I met Peter Mandelson yesterday. Those two are not opposite things, by the way. When I said dating Peter Mandelson,
there was a full stop there, not a semicolon between the two.
Yeah. When I was on College Green a couple of weeks ago, Peter Bone was being interviewed just 6 feet away from me by a different station. And so the Sodom guys had come along and they were all doing impressions of John Burko very, very loudly going, Mr. Peter Bone! And I could just hear this getting louder and louder as I was being interviewed, and I was trying so hard not to laugh. I'd be like, thumbs up.
So just before we wrap up, there's obviously, we've covered a lot. Ian, is there something that in the hypothetical barbecue situation, what is the next thing that people should be... Should be waiting for? What's the kind of takeaway, the next turning point?
I mean, look, the dates that matter at the moment are at the end of this week, start of next, when we get that bill under the statute book. Then it's the EU summit on the 17th and 18th, and the timetable at the end of it on the 19th, in order for the Prime Minister to have to go and extend. This is the period that we're looking at now. Those are the decisive moments, and everything's going to be played out in between those two dates.
That's the end of the show, which means the Brexit time capsule, which is increasingly like a refuge from the outside world. We might pop into it early, but it's meant to be a repository of things we'll need or miss if Brexit ever happens, which, God willing, it won't. Jonathan Liss, you're our guest. What are you putting in there?
I miss a time where small things felt big. Where we could get into incredible sort of frenzy about very, very minor things, because actually it was a more innocent time. And we weren't dealing with real people's lives. We weren't dealing with the future of our democracy. We weren't dealing with an all-out assault on our institutions in the way that we have been on a regular basis the last 3 years. So just a time of just for people to fucking calm down, basically.
There was a great Salman Rushdie quote where he was talking about, you know, the Trump years. And he goes, do you remember when there was just a week where everyone was talking about Charlie Sheen having a meltdown?
Yeah.
And basically, like, take
us back to the mid-90s. You know, that was a great meltdown. That was a happy time.
That was one of my favourite meltdowns, because he made his own language. It was fucking great. Johnny Sheen had one of the best meltdowns I've ever seen. You have just put the concept of small things seeming big into the time capsule. Like, it's quite abstract. That's good.
Jonathan has put his innocence into the time capsule.
Oh, nice. Wow, that went in time capsule a long time ago.
You're just like...
With regular news. You're basically...
Regular news is basically what you want to put, just like the regular rhythm.
If I could sort of just put the atmosphere of the mid-90s. The mid-90s were a time where we had a liberal consensus, or we thought we had, you know, where people were talking about the end of history and how arrogant, how hubristic that was, because it's never the end of history. There's always just another fucking thing waiting to happen after this one.
I love the way that Francis Fukuyama is going to spend the rest of his life going, no, I didn't mean it that way.
Poor guy. Yeah.
No time for an EU language clip this week, I'm afraid. Too much news. But don't forget to send us your clip to info@romaniacs.com. Keep them short and ideally don't record them somewhere noisy like a motorway, a wind tunnel or the House of Commons when an MP is crossing the floor. And that's the show. Thank you, Naomi and Ian.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan Liss.
Thank you.
It's time for our theme tune by the legendary Corner Shop. It's called Demon is a Monster. You can get a free download at ampleplay.co.uk. Please raise your glasses of stockpiled French wine and Belgian beer as we thank our latest Patreon backers.
Hello, thanks from me to Neil Nixon, David Book, Stephen Richardson, David Bingham, Jacob, thank you, Moggy, John, actually, sorry, Jacob, that's really unfair to you. I take it back. John Herring, Andrew Maynard, Richard Bateman, Andy Green, and Paul Evans. Cheers, guys.
And thank you very much from me to Robert Zinner, Francis White, Red Broad, Robert Collier, Stephanie, Andrew Horner, Carl Jonas Johansson, Hilton Mendelssohn, Dominic Beddow, and Andy Reagan.
And thanks for me to Richard Riley, John Lowry, Jacob Sanderswood, Alexis Taylor, probably not the singer from Hot Chip, but why not? David Clements. Let's say it is. David Clements, John Savage, Kathy Hume, Stephen Headley, Matt Osler, and Andrew Reed. See you next week. Romaniacs was presented by me, Dorian Linsky. The producer is Andrew Harrison, and studio production by Sophie Black. Romaniacs is a Podmasters production. We'll be right back.